Okay, we're going to jump right into this. My name is Cindy Levering. I'm a retired actuary from Aon Consulting. I've been retired for about 4 years, so it was before it was Aon Hewitt. So I tend to just call it Aon. And I'm a volunteer with both the Society of Actuaries and the Academy of Actuaries. And Anne was involved with 2020 from the very beginning, and I came to the Society as a volunteer shortly thereafter. So was involved with 2020 since about 2006, shortly after the first conference. I've been very pleased and excited to stay involved with this whole initiative because it's very exciting, very important. So we're going to talk now about alignment. Oh, and just one note, Michael Krebs, who was going to be on this panel, wasn't able to stay. So we've got Paul and Rocky both joining us, and Don First from the Academy. So we're going to talk about alignment, which is our first principle. And actually, when we started the 2020 after our initial conference, we actually had a whole conference just on, and this is the report from it, which is still on our website, a whole conference just on alignment, aligning roles with skills, because it was such an important thing, and so many of the problems that we were experiencing in the system were because skills and roles were misaligned. So basically, it's asking people, stakeholders, which Anne defines stakeholders as employers, employees, and society, and within that, government acting as an agent of society, asking them to do what they're best suited to do, clearly defining roles, and of course, the most common misalignment of roles is between employees and employers. We all know that most employees don't have the skills to manage their own finances. They don't, you know, that we all know all of this stories about financial literacy and the lack of that. So we need to do what we can to give people well-structured choices, well-defined choices, and not ask them to do too much. And also giving them limiting unstructured choices. Incorporating auto features, and we've talked about that, I think in just about every speaker has talked about auto features and defaults, employing professionals where possible, and providing incentives and tax and other policies. We talked about protecting society from suboptimal decisions in terms of laws and regulations that enhance our systems, balancing voluntary incentives with mandatory requirements. As I was saying, we want to align each stakeholder's roles properly with their skills, possibly redefining the employer role by placing responsibility for certain things with, maybe a third party. Some big employers, are still going to want to manage their own plans. They have the ability and the resources to do that, but smaller employers may not. And they might be happy just to be a conduit and let a third party take care of that. And of course, individuals, we talked about that, having their choices be well-defined. They can be overwhelmed. A lot of the research we do with the Society of Actuaries shows that people have very short planning horizons in general. They're not thinking, more than maybe 10 years into the future, whereas when you're talking about managing your retirement income, you've got to think a lot longer than that. We've got a lot of auto features on the pre-retirement phase, but not so much in the post-retirement phase. The whole discussion about lifetime income, just not only the fact that you've got to do that for a long period of time, but at some point your cognitive abilities may start to decline, and it may become more difficult to manage your finances. We've got some questions, and I'm happy to take questions from the floor, too, for the panelists about just alignment in particular, particular things in the plans that they represent, or just kind of general philosophical questions. So let me get it started, and the one thing that I was wondering, do you all in your, either of your systems provide individuals with any kind of modeling tools to help them understand the benefits that they're getting from the plan and, you know, maybe model different scenarios, different retirement ages, things like that?
A former client, not a current client, they actually had a very robust modeling system. It was a cash balance plan. They did not have lump sum options except for a very limited basis, like you could get maybe 20% of your benefit as lump sum, but not the whole thing. But they had a very robust model. If you were, say, 25 or 30, you could project different in economic environments, salary increases, investment returns, to see where you might be at the end of the day. And they had safeguards in there, so you couldn't say assume 12% investment return and 1% inflation, because it over a long period of time. But that was very helpful in people understanding what they had. Yeah.
Paul, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, plan sponsors are required to give illustrations to employees on their options, basically within the last 5 years before normal retirement date or on request. But I thought it might be worth taking up a couple of Mark's points. When we started pension reform in Canada, we had a situation where one-third of women over 65 were at the poverty line or below, but only 5 to 10% of men were. So we had a national pension conference and to look at the solutions, and the result of that was essentially twofold. One, it eliminated the lump sum option because the data we had showed that women were in and out of the workforce for family raising and whatnot, and they had very high rates of surrender of taking lump sums when they left. Or they were cashing in their money to provide the down payment for a family house, and they weren't necessarily getting it back later on. So we still provided, if you will, a lump sum option, but that lump sum could only be applied in a life annuity or in something equivalent to an annuity certain age 90. It had to be used for income and retirement. And that's it. There was no choice to take a lump sum and spend it. The second option that was eliminated at that time is men could not retire. Well, nobody could retire without providing a minimum last survivor annuity to their spouse. And what we found between 1983, when the decision was made, and 1999, as we reduced the rate of female poverty among the pensioners down to around 7%, cut it in three quarters. So that was an all-party decision, went through unanimously through the House of Commons, and it's worked. So that's another way around. I don't minimize the difficulty of getting anything through your Congress on an all-party basis right now, but we had a different system. So it's required by law that you have those options. And when I retired in December 2006, I had a choice of taking a life annuity or of taking a commuted value on a legally specified basis and either turning it over to an investment manager or managing it myself, but I had to withdraw amounts as if it was a modified annuity certain at age 90. There's a minimum amount you can withdraw each year and a maximum amount you can withdraw each year. And my personal concern was I didn't know when I was going to go gaga. And I was quite happy to have the life annuity option, but I was the exception among the partners in my actuarial consulting firm. They all thought they could beat the market. Mm. And I think all of my partners lost $1 million or more in 2008. That's not that we're really rich, it's just that pensions have a very high commuted value.
I wanted to comment on that a little. I've not seen many plans that give people modeling tools on really demonstrating what the risks are in retirement and what would be best for them in selecting that. On the other hand, and this kind of relates to an issue Mark brought up earlier also, I've seen lots of plans that give people modeling tools during their career on how to do their investment allocation and how to accumulate wealth for their retirement. Now, the interesting thing about that is most of those modeling tools encourage diversified portfolios with some risk-taking and generally have a rate of return that's earned over that period of time that includes some risk premium. They're not investing for 20 or 30 or 40 years throughout their career at a 3% investment return. It's something higher than that because of the risk that they take on. Now, when those same people at retirement look at the option between a life annuity and a lump sum, if they've learned anything from those modeling tools throughout their career, they're going to recognize that the investment return on that annuity, particularly today, is maybe 3%, maybe 3.5% today. And that's not what they're used to from the modeling tool that incorporates some diversification and some risk. When you combine that with the fact that we know from behavioral finance that people have a very high discount rate when they're looking out to the future, and they value things that are closer in time much more than they do things that are distant. When you combine those, the annuity looks like a terrible choice because of that very low return that it's earning. And I think that we need much better ways to demonstrate that what the value of the annuity is not necessarily the investment return. Actually, I'll throw out two possibilities here. One is the value is not the investment return, it's the longevity protection. And we need to find ways to demonstrate the value of that longevity protection rather than the guaranteed interest rate. For those of you that know my favorite angle on retirement planning, I'd like to see the annuity provided without that guaranteed interest rate. Let them also experience the benefit of diversification in their retirement portfolio. I personally don't want to tie up a lot of assets at a 3% return. I think we're better off eliminating the absolute guarantee of this lifetime income, allow the benefit to fluctuate, and give the people the benefit of a diversified portfolio. Some of the shared risk models that we've talked about do that. The idea that I talk about a lot that does that is the immediate variable annuity, where you can take as little or as much risk in it as you want. But I think ways to demonstrate to people the value of that longevity risk or the value of taking some diversification risk in retirement would be very useful.
You know, just to pick up on Don's point, that's effectively what we've tried to do in the New Brunswick model. The initial annuity that you draw is essentially has been based on a 4.5% discount rate. You have a diversified portfolio, and the excess earnings are flowed through to you in the form of annuity enhancements. Mm-hmm. So you have the benefit of the asset diversification. You have a reserve set up. And if you don't make the 4.5% over some time, then you have the possibility of a benefit reduction. We found that is accepted very well we've converted every single public sector plan in the province now, I guess, and working on the private sector. It seems people seem to be able to understand it.
Okay. What about mandatory versus voluntary participation in plans? That one of the things we said early on is that in our Aegis principle, we intentionally did not say everyone had to be covered. The coverage had to be mandatory, although obviously universal access is important, and the more people we can get in makes the system more efficient. But could you talk a little bit about your system or your personal views about mandatory versus voluntary participation?
It's an interesting issue because from the viewpoint of the public, I think we'd rather have mandatory for everyone. Because at the end of the day, whoever doesn't have enough to retire on, we end up paying for anyway. The private sector, the private employers, you know, they're not the government. So when the person leaves their employee, they're not responsible for them, except indirectly through how they support the governments in the area. So I think there should be a really strong minimal level of mandatory participation. We have that in Social Security for the most part, except for certain governmental employees. But that extra piece, extra oomph from that, maybe like the Harkin bill, would be another minimal leg to get us up there a little bit better than we are. It's the voluntary nature of it. I mean, I have two kids. They're both in their 20s. And I hammer on those two kids, maximize whatever they let you do in the 401k, maximize it, because right now is when you need to do it. But it's still difficult because, you know, you're in your 20s, you got kids, you got expenses, you're starting out, you don't want to think about retirement. So mandatory might be a better way to go long term.
You say maybe at some minimal level.
Yeah,
so maybe we can come up with some right. compromise. Paul, I don't know, what's the climate like in Canada for mandatory participation?
Well, we've been losing DB plans and losing pension plans in general. And so the first task of the pension task force was to stop the loss. And in order to do that, we had to devise a system that had contribution stability for the employer. Contribution stability and affordable contributions at the same time. So our focus was to save everything we had, and we haven't had a single pension plan canceled in the province for the last 3.5 years. We've been able to save everything and convert all the government, and now the private sector's converting over very quickly. The mandatory part that we have in what's converted is the price of getting into the new system is mandatory coverage of all pension plan, of all members in, of the member employees of the employer. So typically old plans used to just cover full-time employees. The price of getting into the new system is that you cover all full-time, part-time, and casual. And that's just it. That's the price of getting the relief from the volatility for the plan sponsor. And there's been no objection whatsoever from any plan to expanding the coverage, to have mandatory coverage of all employees. The next stage is to try and go back to plans that have converted to DC or have discontinued and try to get them to start up again. And we'll see. That's a job for after the election. The government's bitten off as much as it can chew. The election is September, the third week of September. And so it's basically closed down plan conversion as of last week. You just don't want to keep upsetting the electorate or make the as you approach an election. That practical politics 101.
I'm real torn on this issue of mandatory versus voluntary. I wrote a paper for the 2020 process that suggested a mandatory system, but at the same time, I have to recognize we already have a mandatory system that's 12.5% of pay up to a certain threshold in Social Security, and part of that split half and half between employer and employee. In the defined benefit systems that we used to have and still have some. Today, participation is generally mandatory or automatic for people, but they're not contributing their own funds. It's the employer, and the employer voluntarily decides to do that. So it's really not a mandatory system in that sense. So it's difficult. I recognize a lot of efficiencies from having everybody participate, but at the same time, it's difficult, I think, in our country to mandate to people that they must save when we already have a system that's supposed to provide a reasonable benefit and keep people out of poverty in retirement. Now whether or not it effectively does that, or you might even quarrel with exactly the objective there, but Social Security is a very efficient system that's mandatory and already has a big part of our compensation going into it. We could argue as to whether or not it keeps people out of poverty. Maybe it needs to be a little bigger, or maybe some people say it's too big. I like the idea of that being our mandatory system, and that additional savings beyond that is voluntary, and we're not forced to do that. We're not forcing everyone in our society to do that. At the same time, I recognize that it sure would be a lot more efficient at savings if everybody was in the system. So it's a difficult, I think it's a very difficult one that we'll continue to debate a lot in our country.
Yep.
Some comments based on both the first two questions, because it seems that part of the alignment to me, and this kind of goes back to some of the questions that Mark asked, it seems there's two kind of fundamental questions that are needed to kind of get the alignment right. And I think one is the question of what you're trying to target. And the question came up earlier this morning, well, what is an adequate income? But I think it's a question that's cannot be simply defined as at age 60 or 65, what are you targeting? I've always felt that you're really trying to target age 80 or 85. What is that mandatory minimum when you are likely have no additional resources? What is that piece that you're trying to target? And as Don was saying, that's, you know, this mandatory system that says we're trying to cover that seems to make sense from that standpoint. But then I've got this more flexible period. And the slide that kind of caught my attention from this morning was one that Paul had, where he talked about the risk profile of the plan before and after, you know, trying to say, how is it trying to target? And we'd set, you know, they set the criteria that said we've got a 95% probability of achieving certain funded targets. And the main message there is that I have a choice between accepting cutting off the top and enhancing my security. And from the private sector, most of the insurance industry, his annuity industry, has been, in a sense, trying to figure out how do I sell a product that is somewhere along a differing risk tolerance. So there's the variable annuity that Don talks about that has no guarantees, and then I start adding in guarantees. There's a fixed annuity that can add some equity participation. But out of that, technically there is a real good understanding of where I'm kind of moving along that risk profile. So as I look at disclosure and try and say, what is it that in the end would be helpful? If we're trying to say that both employers and employees need to have some understanding of the risk exposure and some option there, then it's really taking that kind of chart that Paul had and trying to say, okay, as an employer, I could give you a choice. You can have a risky return. You can have, here's how it affects you up to age 80. Here's what happens after age 80. I've probably got a different risk profile depending on what I'm targeting there. But there's kind of two kinds of decisions that you're then saying, and the question of optionality and saying, can I understand as an individual what I'm trying to target for the last years of my life? And then in addition, where am I after that as far as how much risk upside I'd like to give up in order to make sure I've got some kind of guarantee? And again, this to me is a conversation that's still in the, wouldn't it be nice if we could do it? But having seen so much progress in other items in the last 10 years that we're starting to come along, I'm curious to get your thoughts as to how likely or possible is it to kind of be including those kinds of conversations, not only within our academy work, but within your professional work.
Well, I guess that also gets to the question of having choices be limited and structured and well-defined, because you talked about a lot of things that, you know, for the average person to wrap their head around that and, you know, think of all these different annuity vehicles and features. And when I retired 4 years ago, I took my 401k and I wanted to buy an annuity with it. And I worked with my financial advisor and we were looking at all these companies and all these products. And my husband finally just said, look, you just need to like focus it. I mean, I had a hard time even picking my annuity option from my defined benefit plan. And so I think about the average person just being totally overwhelmed by this. I think we have to think about how we can make this, you know, more accessible for people to, you know, to come to those, you know, the best decision. I mean, it's, you know, you're never going to make the absolute perfect decision. I guess that's one of my questions too, is how does your system or your proposal help people with those very difficult choices?
Well, let me talk about the way employers looked at it, at least in Canada. Somewhere between 1980 and the end of the 90s, pensions stopped being seen as an expense and seemed to be seen as a profit center. And so the employers were focused on taking high risk, high rewards in order to reduce their share of the pension contributions. And that mentality continued right through the 90s and even through the dot-com bust for a little while. And then the fall in interest rates meant that there weren't excess gains to flow through into the corporate bottom line. And gradually, sometime I say between 2003, 2008, 2009, the objectives of management switched from profit generation to loss containment or cost containment. And certainly, well, the markets have rebounded somewhat. What we found in dealing with pension plans in New Brunswick anyway is that the idea of taking a hybrid plan and getting a fixed contribution became very, very attractive to employers. But when we started out that, when we started our consultations, which is about 4 years ago, we had consulting actuaries stand up and literally shout us down that the employers will never give up the chance to run pensions as a profit center. Well, that has disappeared. That type of thinking has disappeared. It hasn't been a profit center. And so, in a way, this is, going through the Great Recession has been salutary in terms of focusing plan sponsors on what they really want to achieve. And so they were very receptive to giving up the top end in that chart I showed, giving up the top end performance in order to limit the downside so that when we had an economic downturn, they wouldn't be hit with increased costs just at the time that their profits sewer because it's a rough economy. And so I think we're somewhat taking advantage of economic circumstances and saying you can get out of those problems now. And what we're finding is that there's a big, big take up. People want to get out from under it, but they don't want to give up their, if they can get out of the volatility in their pension benefits, they're happy with maintaining sharing the rewards to limit the risk.
I think your question raises a point also of that sheds a little insight on why employers are getting out of this market in some sense. You raise the question of what do the plans do to really help people with all this and everything, and I think it's instructive that a lot of employers many years ago adopted a retirement plan of one form or another, thinking they were just helping their employees save or save money for retirement or somehow that get to have a retirement. And gradually over many years, they just developed so many more responsibilities from that plan. So many things that they had to do in terms of helping them with investment modeling, with the choices in retirement, so many more fiduciary responsibilities that came with this plan, that it's increased the burden on employers a lot, and I think is part of the reason why many of them want to get to the simplest plan they can or even not have a plan. I think it's something that points out the advantage of some of the more innovative proposals that we've had. For instance, the USA retirement plan that Michael talked about earlier today. It doesn't take over for the employment. They consciously say we don't want to compete with the existing model, but maybe we need something that really does compete with the existing model. Really tough competition for them somehow. That's not that doesn't put so much burden on the employer, where some type of organization that really wanted to do this core kind of work of helping the participant, the employee, make the decisions that they need to make throughout their career and in retirement, and do that. And it's quite a burden that we're putting on the employer in this voluntary system. And I don't think we should be surprised that a lot of employers choose not to do that. So I think these questions bring up some insights that we've got to think about too.
I would push back a little bit, Don.
Sure.
If I may. The employers, originally, when we started retirement plans back in the 1910s and 1920s, it was to control the workforce. They had old people that couldn't handle the mechanisms they were working, so they would go make them go home. And then in the 40s and 50s, when they needed more people to go home. And then they didn't like the price tag later on, so they wanted to change it. Because there's a greed element that goes into it. I don't disagree with you. We got to be careful, because there's a certain limit to what the employers can handle. But in my opinion, they can handle more than they're doing now. But that might be a matter of difference. But the overarching thing is something you mentioned earlier. We have basis of Social Security, but we have no overarching national policy on what we want our retirement program to do. In 1980, the Presidential Commission on Retirement attempted to start a policy, which was killed almost immediately after the changes in the 80s when the market took off, because no one was talking about that. So we don't have a policy. It's like, you know, Alice in Wonderland with the Cheshire Cat. Asked Alice, where are you going? If you don't know, how do you know when you're going to get there? We don't know. And that's a real big issue. To go back to your original question, though, I think as far as particularly which we've been working hard on are the lower income, smaller employers. And for those folks, you really need to remove a lot of these choices from the employees, because there is no way, regardless of how well you explain it, they can understand it. I mean, you're an actuary. You've been in the business, you know the stuff, and it's difficult for you to understand. I mean, how do you expect an 11th grade educated mechanic to understand the finer workings of how to make these options? They're not going to. It makes it difficult.
I think that really goes to the alignment principle that we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Of getting people being able to do the things, asking them to do the things in these plans that they are clearly capable of doing and can do well. And asking somebody else to do the other things that they can't do well, whether that's the employer or some other entity that fulfills that responsibility.
Can I give a different type of alignment that we seem to have achieved almost without suspecting we were going to get it? And I'll use the hospital workers plan, the nurses plan. We had a situation where the nurses plan, the old plan, was a final average salary plan. And that gives a lot of incentive to stay working up to the time you maximize your final salary. And what we found was nurses were continuing to work, but the rate of absenteeism was increasing. They wouldn't retire. They wanted to stay in the workforce, but they couldn't come in every day of the week. Because it's too heavy to lug a cardiac patient around or whatever for an older nurse. Well, when we switched to an updated career average system, the incentive to work full-time is not there. You can run a program where you phase yourself out from 5 days to 4 days to 3 days to 2 days. Hmm. And what we found in the 2 years is that the nurses are doing exactly that. And we found the rate of absenteeism has dropped. So if you change the benefits to fit the lifestyle they want, they'll elect the lifestyle they want if they get a fair deal on the benefits. And we think we're really onto something here, because just getting rid of the absentee days and having people tailor their working career to phase themselves out seems to be accommodated by the new system. And now that's the longest serve, the first plan we converted, most experience. We've got 2 years experience now, but it seems to be working. And we didn't set out with that as an objective, but we certainly talked about it as a possibility on the way through, and it seems to be happening.
Just let me make one note. Obviously, we're running a little over. We're going to take 5 minutes off each of the afternoon sessions to get back on track. Mm-hmm. We're going to have about five more minutes here. So if there are more questions from the audience.
We do have a few more questions here in the audience.
Okay. Hi. You know, I'm interested in the definition of the stakeholders here. So we have three listed: individuals, employers, society, mm-hmm. and then there's this mysterious group that seems to be referenced as third parties and appropriate entities, and obviously there's a sort of a large group that doesn't really fit into those three categories, that really about people who are sort of servicing the retirement world.
Right, and there, when we originally started 2020, we did define a fourth kind of stakeholder, that we called the markets, which, you know, we didn't mention today, but yeah, we have recognized that the markets, which is the place where, you know, all of this is taking place, is in a sense a stakeholder, not in the same sense as the others, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would define it as the stakeholders, okay. But I mean, I guess my question is why aren't they called out specifically, and if you did, what might you say about them?
You all have comments?
Of the stakeholders?
So if you were to, so there were references to these other entities embedded, you know, in the slides, for example, right? And frankly, there are a lot of people in this room who represent this other sort of broadly defined group of stakeholders, right? It's people who are involved in the retirement system, service the retirement system. I think, you know, Michael Krebs and Mark Every would certainly say that they're stakeholders because they're knocking on their door a lot of the time, trying to influence what the system looks like.
Well, I think I mentioned that in society, including that government acting as an agent for society, and I don't know if that.
No, I wasn't referencing government as some separate stakeholder. Yes, they're sort of society. What I'm saying is, you know, we're talking about actuaries, lawyers, mm-hmm. You know, the mutual fund companies, mm-hmm. just money managers generally, all are stakeholders in the system, and they definitely try to influence the system. We're referencing them as having a role, and actually when you talk about redefining the employer role, you're talking about shifting some of the responsibilities to these other entities that don't fit in the three categories that are up here. And so my questions are, you know, why haven't they been called out as a separate set of stakeholders? And if they were, what would you say about them, at least in this specific area of alignment? And obviously it's relevant to the other areas like governance as well.
Yeah, my own thought on that is that in the Retirement 2020 project, as that developed, and maybe some of the other folks that were more involved in that will have a comment, they were looked at as providers to the system or as kind of vendors to the system, and that the stakeholders were considered to be the ones who had a more direct stake in what was going on, the employee in terms of getting the retirement income, the employer from funding it, and all the service providers were at least in that concept, not considered a stakeholder. But certainly I understand your perspective that they are. In some regards, they certainly are.
If I understood what you were saying correctly, and I'm not saying I did, but I would say the professional side of it, our stake in it, is what part of what we're doing here today is to uphold the integrity of the profession and make sure that the advice we give people is legitimate and appropriate for the situation. Now, and part of this is, you know, actuaries, by their nature, we have a stake in DB plans continuous because we get work off of it. We have to be careful not to let that cloud the whole judgment of helping people make good decisions. Did I miss your point?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're kind of all interwoven in, you know, into all the aspects of
Yeah, if
system.
I could characterize it just real with slightly different words, I'd say that the stakeholders that we talked about in the 2020 project were what you might call principals, as opposed to people, agents or servicing the principals or helping the principals, which is what I think a lot of the industry does. But you're absolutely right. Some of the ideas that have been proposed are transferring and making them principals directly involved. Certainly, I think the Retirement USA plan is like that.
So thank you very much. I think we're at time, and we'll move on to governance.